Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. Today is Friday. Actually, I'm writing down the wrong notes. Friday, September 16th, and it's a little after 11 a.m. I am C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for the day as we continue a conversation about service and the call of duty. And to help me with this discussion, once again, I have the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Public Service, Mr. Frederick Mitchell, who, when he was here with me last time, he continued a conversation about his legacy in a brief wording, but basically his history of growing up in the Bahamas, joining the PLP, him being the activist, and I want to continue that conversation, and then I'm going to ask him one or two questions concerning the public service and foreign affairs in general. But I want to start the conversation where he left off, or where I think he left off, which was circa 1984. He was just coming home away from university. He was in the UK studying law, if I remember correctly. And it was around that time when there was a commission of inquiry. Right, it was some uncertain time, some uneasiness time, and as a result of the commission of inquiry, persons like Hubert Ingram was fired, and Perry, former prime minister, so let me show that respect, were fired from the Progressive Liberal Party for a period of time, and persons were resigned from the party because of the commission inquiry. And I wanted to know the temperament of the Bahamas at the time, the temperament and the emotions that the minister felt when he was away in school, and him coming back to the Bahamas and eventually becoming an advocate, an activist per se, where he eventually formed his own political party, right? He became known as the spokesperson for civil rights inside the Bahamas at that era, right? And I wanted to start that conversation in his own words, what transpired post the commission inquiry. And I just wanted to welcome Mr. Mitchell again and thank him very much for agreeing to come back onto the show. And welcome, Minister.
Great, thank you very much. I just should say that following Sir Lyndon's death in 2000, I wrote an essay called Pinling and Me, and it's been published, and so anyone who wants to go over all of this can find it because it's already in writing. And so the story is there, and I'll basically just be repeating what I've already written.
Okay.
But yeah, it's there. I think the Pinling and Me, the essay is actually online there as well, if you wish to read it.
No, that's even easier to just get and have a discussion on that. Right. But I appreciate that. But let me ask up a specific question, right? We know that you became an independent senator within the FNM, that you were selected to be a senator. We wanted to understand, how did that come about?
Okay, so go back to 1984. I'm still in law school, and the events of the Commission of Inquiry transpired. Mm-hmm. I think the Commission of Inquiry reported in October of 1984, and there was a minority report which indicated that the report on the then Prime Minister's finances were led to some uncertainty about the sources of funding. The result was that there was two things happened. The two members of the government were going to be dismissed. Arthur Hanna was resigning, and two others resigned. So this was all taking place while I was in the UK. It came, I think, as a result of planned changes in the government following a conclave which took place in Chubb Key. And Mr. Hanna objected to his moving from the Ministry of Finance. And then this precipitated a whole cascading set of events. So I spoke to Paul Adley, who was then at the United Nations in New York. Mrs. Hanna, Mrs. Arthur Hanna, had called me and said, look, this is about to happen. Or I had spoken to her and told her what I had understood was about to happen, put it that way. Paul Adley was in New York. I spoke to him on the phone and asked him what he proposed to do. And he said that he was basically going to stick with the government as it was. And then these events unfolded. I thought that in the circumstances, both Mr. Christie and Mr. Ingram had been treated unfairly. And I aligned my political interest with them. And so it became increasingly awkward on a personal level with the then Prime Minister. So when I came back, those wounds, so to speak, had not healed. And I was interested in getting a nomination for Parliament. And so the two men, Christie and Ingram, had been talking about a third party. In fact, I thought it was called the Third Force.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Ingram and myself went around the country together on a series of lectures called the Milo Butler Lectures on the Constitution. And this took us to a number of islands. In fact, when he did his book launch the other day, he mentioned that we did this together, and the speech which he delivered in Bimini was, in fact, written by me. And, you know, I've been a speech writer for all of them, with the exception of Hubert Minnis. I thought, though, that they were just taking a little too long to get this thing off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided with a number of colleagues, we had a meeting over at what is now the Warwick, in what was then, or at one time, was Al Colley's club.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a meeting there and decided to form something called the People's Democratic Force, which is PDF.
Mm-hmm.
And we began there, and we just started going around the country, going around the island, basically proselytizing that message. What you discovered now, I think in retrospect, is two things. The history of third parties in the country is not a very good one.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you a list starting from the Etienne de Puch's Bahamian Democratic League, BDL. And each of them have gone down in flames. And the idea has always been that you could get people of goodwill from either side, and they can get together and form this third party, which would magically and almost independently govern the country. The fact is, though, there's a left and there's a right in the Bahamas. And most of these third parties, as you now see, even as they develop now, are essentially entertainment for the public.
Mm-hmm.
In between the terms, they provide and say the things which the more centrist parties cannot repeat in public. So they are at the extremes. And but when it comes time to the general election, you'll find that everybody has to disaggregate between either PLP or FNM. And so as we got to the election in 1992,
mm-hmm.
I was seeking to run under my own party label, seeking to run in the Centerville constituency. I grew up in Centerville and Collins Avenue. And the FNM thought, I had a meeting with Sir Orville Turnquest, later with Hubert Ingram, and they asked me if I would step aside, allow their candidate to have a clean shot, and that would not muddy the water, so to speak. And with that, they thought they had a better chance of winning. In exchange for that, I would get one of these seats that sort of sits in the middle. Traditionally, they've been in the middle. Well, in the sense that even though they're appointed by the Prime Minister, they are actually a rump from the previous constitution, the 1964 constitution, when they were actually independent senators. And when the constitution was changed in 1969, the three, which were supposed to reflect the balance of the House and after consultation with the leader of the opposition, was the rump of that sort of independent group. And I got one of those in exchange for stepping back from running in Centerville. The second retrospective comment I would have to make on it is that not only is the third party phenomenon a field of entertainment for the public, but secondly, it is also a marketing tool for those people who want to get into politics and have to end up eventually going to one of the major parties. So what tends to happen also when you look at the history of this stuff is the major parties look at those people who are engaged in the proselytizing in these so-called third parties or fringe groups, and they, as the election gets closer, they pluck people of talent from those groups.
And you mentioned third parties, right? And you went in detail on how you see them or in general how they impact the Bahamas and their successes or failures. What were the theatrics that is happening now from the third party force?
Well,
right?
It's the same phenomenon. Mm-hmm. There's the same phenomenon. So I was in a conversation a couple of days ago with leader of the opposition, who was responding to my public statement about the connection between the Free National Movement and the demonstrators in the public square. And, you know, he said, well, you know, I'm not associated with that. But I said, if you look at the cast of characters and who is there, it's easy to, you know, add one and one and say that equals two. So it's the same script which is unfolding. Third parties do the things that the major parties can't do, and they provide plausible deniability for the things that are done by third parties. It gives you a fig leaf that says, it wasn't me. So, as I said, to complete the thought, that as you come closer to the general elections, the major parties then pluck people of talent from these third parties, and they join up, and they eventually end up being members of parliament under those third that from third parties. They end up being either FNM or PLP.
Oh, let's talk about referendums in general. Your opinion of them. It seems as if in the Bahamas we tend not to deal with it well, right? And I just want to know your general opinion of referendums. Will there be any referendums? Because at one point in time, under the past Christie administration, we supposed to have constitutional referendums as a part of the culture of the PLP. And it seems that now we're timid to even suggest the words. And when you call referendums, we shut down.
And for good reasons. You get gun shy about it. Referendum throughout the Caribbean, this is not just a Bahamian phenomenon, but they are essentially a point at which the opposition parties can build on dissatisfaction or disgruntlement with the public over government policy. And so it's a verdict not really on the referendum itself, but really something which is meant to poke the government in the eye, because you can do it. So that's the way it's turned out for us. I've had experience with, I guess, three of them and one attempt. Mm-hmm. The first of which is when I came back from Harvard in 1980. The then Prime Minister, Lyndon Pinling, asked me to join his office again, working out of the Bahamas Information Services, to run the campaign for an attempt which was being made to amend the Constitution in 1980. There was a decision called Ryan and the Attorney General, which went all the way up to the Privy Council, fought by Sir Cecil Wallace Whitfield, who was then leader of the opposition. And that case overturned a decision by the then government to not grant citizenship to Darcy Ryan. Darcy Ryan was a man who had something called belonger status. Belonger status was the closest you could get to being a Bahamian citizen before independence. And there were big arguments over this at the constitutional talks in London about whether this class of persons should actually be allowed to be Bahamians. In any event, the Constitution provided a specific provision for them to become Bahamians. And Darcy Ryan, after the change in constitutions in 1973, applied for citizenship, and it was refused. And it was refused on the grounds that granting it would be contrary to public policy. The Privy Council said that that was overly broad, and that if you wanted, so they struck down the provisions in the Bahamas Nationality Act, which gave the basis upon which the decision could be taken. They said that that was unconstitutional. And they also said that if you wanted to turn someone down in those circumstances, you had to actually give the person an opportunity to be heard. In other words, the person was entitled to what they called a fair hearing. And so you had to specifically say, I am turning you down for citizenship for this reason and this reason. And you gave you would give thereby the person a chance or an opportunity to say, well, no, that's not true. And it's only after that happened that you could then turn down the citizenship. So the Darcy Ryan case took place. And after that case, the then administration decided that they would amend the Constitution, to make it clear that the government and the government alone granted citizenship in the Bahamas. So it was meant to reverse the result of Darcy, Ryan and the Attorney General. Well, that went along. There was a campaign. The Prime Minister went out across the country. And then, I think it was in the fall of 1981, the then Anglican bishop was Michael Eldon. And in those days, the charge of the Anglican bishop at the start of synod was the thing everybody listened for, because you wanted to hear what the Anglican bishop had to say about it. And he spoke at the synod, I think 1981, and said, essentially, this is a dead issue. Don't fool with it. We don't support it. It's a bad idea. And the whole thing died on the vine. So it never actually got to be put to people. So the next opportunity for a referendum was when Hubert Ingraham decided that he was going to amend the Constitution to create, amongst other things, a teachers' commission, equality for women. That, of course, went down in flames because there was no consensus on it. And then we tried. We thought we had a consensus. But as soon as it went to the voters, the leader of the opposition then said, well, vote your conscience. And so that meant his supporters vote against it. And that went down in flames. So now we have people talking about referenda again mm-hmm. to deal with. The only way you can deal with the phenomenon that are in the public domain now, if you're dealing with any of the vested provisions of the Constitution, like citizenship or the question of whether we are a republic or a monarchy, they require a referendum. And so that's how it's come back in the public domain. But I think you're right. There's no appetite for it. It's not on the agenda. And as I said in our public statement a couple of days ago, on the citizenship and asylum issues, we are satisfied that the law, as it presently stands, allows us to do all of the things which are necessary to be done in connection with citizenship and asylum procedures. And so, therefore, it's not currently being considered and not in circulation. And it's my expectation that it's not actually on the agenda.
Okay. Just now you mentioned the monarchy and a referendum regarding that. I know you had some strong views when you were younger about coming to Bahamas, transitioning to a republic. I would like to know what your views are on that again, just to remind the audience. And also, is this going to be a laborious task, or is this going to be something easy if we have ever decided to become a republic?
Well, as I said, the Prime Minister said we should actually wait until after the period of mourning to be discussing the pros and cons.
Then I'll move quickly. Yeah. I understand.
I prefer to avoid that trap at the moment.
Yes. Then I will counter with this. Once upon a time, when I was younger, I would put it this way, because you know you frequent our school and give speeches. We labeled you as being a regionalist, right? You purported CSME.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. And I'm not sure where CSME is now, right?
It's a dead issue. Yeah.
But
we signed the Treaty of Chaguaramas, but we were able to sign it without agreeing to those provisions. So all of the provisions about functional cooperation, the cooperation on the institutions in CARICOM, we are all a part of those, but we're not part of the single market and economy.
Okay. I see I have a text here who wants to be, mind you, you said it last time we were here. They want you to refresh their memory about you burning the Constitution. I know it's a symbolic issue, and I know you went in detail of what happened the last time. But if you could briefly, in short sentences, their benefit.
That was over, you know, there was a demonstration about freedom of speech. There was a judge named Gonzalo Cibola, who reported me to the Bar Association because I said he ought to have been dismissed as a judge and didn't like the way I spoke about it. So he complained to the Chief Justice about it, and the Chief Justice referred it to the Ethics Commission of the Bar. And so there was a public demonstration in response to it, and that's what that was about.
Yes, and you, like I said, you went in detail about it. Was basically that you was expressing that freedom of speech was being threatened, and that, you did a symbolic boat burning of the Constitution.
It wasn't symbolic, an actual
burning. You burned it, I mean, you actually burned the Constitution.
The symbolism was, but you can't burn the Constitution. Constitution is not the document in writing. The Constitution is
I mean, there are some rights. People who still vex that you did it.
Oh, well.
You know, it is what it
they'll
is.
Get over it.
I want to talk about your ministry, briefly, nothing in detail, but I know that there is now a school. Okay, first of all, I want to establish that within your budget, you made it a provision that you can form a school where diplomats are trained.
Yes, and Diplomatic Institute.
And I want to know briefly, because I really want to know what is it about, the outlying of it, so we can understand and appreciate what is it, the intent and the benefits of it for the Bahamas in general.
Well, I'll tell you this story. I was sitting with some Foreign Service officers in Eleuthera at a restaurant one evening, and one of the youngsters that we had at dinner asked them, "What does a Foreign Service officer do?" And I was really surprised that the officer couldn't answer the question. So, in short, the Diplomatic Institute is meant to solve that problem so that when you come in as a raw recruit to the Foreign Service, you at least get the fundamentals about what a Foreign Service officer does and what the Foreign Service is responsible for. There is an act which governs the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, creates it as a corporation sole, and the Foreign Ministry is responsible for all communications between foreign states and the Bahamas. So if a foreign state wants to come here, wants to talk to the Bahamas, the first point of contact is the chief of protocol at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and then things go on from there. And we're responsible for looking at treaties, we're responsible for visas, we're responsible for passports, and for relationships with the diaspora, with any kind of political developments between countries, and for negotiating treaties, as I said, with countries overseas.
Yeah, but I want to hear more about the school.
So the Diplomatic Institute has now been named after Al Ray Ramsey.
Okay, nice.
Who's a young diplomat who died
in Italy?
In Italy, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Under mysterious circumstances, we still have an outstanding request for the Italians to supply us with satisfactory answers to that. So that's one of the things we're still pursuing.
Okay.
But the Institute is meant to, as I said, to solve that problem in the training. And we've just taken on some people in human resources. It is headed by the Chancellor of the Institute, who is Ambassador Alma Adams.
Mm-hmm.
She's assisted by a very able Foreign Service officer. Her name is Chrissy Hanna. And the idea is that a memorandum of understanding will be signed with the University of the Bahamas to allow it to be the certificate, which is granted by the Institute, will be supported by the Academy at the University of the Bahamas, so that the diplomat who comes out of the school is able to carry that certificate wherever they go, as having grounded them in the whole idea of the Foreign Service.
Okay. And you're also the minister responsible for public service also, right? And I know when you came in as the minister, you made a personal pledge basically to try to fix the system, because the system seems to, for lack of better words, move like molasses. Mm. Things take a while to move through. I'd like to know how's that going? What is your objectives? How are you thinking you're going to move with that?
Very, very difficult proposition. This is my second time being public service minister, and it's a Gordian knot. I'm not sure who can cut the knot and how to resolve it. But what I do think is that we have a very able minister of state who's tackling it on a step-by-step and considered basis. And I say that because I've just come back from a tour of the southern islands of the country. They are perhaps the most impoverished part of the country. And what strikes you is that as people spoke at the public meetings that we attended, many of the questions were in fact about things like, why am I not permanent and pensionable?
Mm-hmm.
How come I've never gotten a raise since I've been working for the public service for years and years? I can't find out why I can't get a promotion. And this has to do with the way the Constitution has set up the public service. So you have a ministry for the public service. That ministry is really a cipher or a conduit. It does the preparatory work for files related to personnel matters, or it is the personnel or human resources department of the public service, and it prepares personnel files to be processed by a body called the Public Service Commission. The Public Service Commission is an independent body which is appointed by the Prime Minister, on the advice of the Prime Minister after consultation with the Leader of the Opposition. And its members, I think there are about five of them, work either part-time or full-time at just processing applications for transfers, promotions, and discipline. And there is a huge backlog, which is difficult, it appears, for the Public Service Commission to process in a timely fashion. So people will call the Public Service Ministry and say, why hasn't this happened? And there are many bottlenecks. Public Service Ministry may be one of them, but it's really, if you go into the Public Service Commission's room, their files piled up, you know. We made a decision before we left office in 2017 that we would migrate all those who were on contract onto the permanent pensionable. That turned out to be about 3,500 people. And when we came back, it had not even been chipped away in any significant way. So the Public Service Commission is still working at it. One of the more egregious examples would be those people who were hired as immigration officers in 2014, 2016, and 2017, three different classes. And we came back to office and found that fully half of those people had not been confirmed, even though they'd been actually working as immigration officers for 4.5 years. They were still at the status of trainee immigration officers. So it's being chipped away. The public is impatient about it. I've explained how it works. But there's another more difficult problem, and that is something we spoke about the last time we were here, which is the actual culture of the country.
Mm.
It's interesting in the culture of our country that is supposed to be guest-oriented in a tourism country, how we actually speak and deal with one another. If you listen to us when we speak in our native language, it always sounds as if we're rowing one another. And then, of course, we have to go to the hotel and then we have to change the way we speak. And I've argued with my colleagues that basically we have to speak two languages, one when we're speaking to ourselves, the other when we speak to the tourists. So what has happened is that in the process, the culture doesn't seem to respect ourselves as individual citizens and the rights which we are supposed to have. And so people think nothing of not processing things in a timely fashion. So for years and years, people have been working in various jobs, and no one from human resources has come to them and said, well, let's look at your career. Let's plot out where it's going. Let's do timely ACRs, which is the way you look at someone's performance. Let's make the recommendations for you to go forward. In some cases, the public service has not held the assessment tests in years and years and years. So people are stuck at a rank which requires an assessment test, but the test has never been done or the course has never been given. So all of that is what the public service ministry is responsible for doing, except, of course, the decision-making with regard to it. And, you know, Pia Glover has a very difficult job ahead of her, but as I said, she's quite able and adept at doing it, and I try my best to assist as the substantive minister. She also, of course, deserves congratulations for the work she's done in bringing the various agreements between the trades unions to fruition and to bring them to an agreement. And the only one that's left outstanding is the Bahamas Public Service Union, and hopefully that'll be tied up quickly.
I want to also have your commentary on the role of an MP. You seem to be you've proven to be the most matured MP in terms of understanding the job, understanding the requirements of what Bahamians seek for an MP. But today's Bahamians, in terms of our culture, wants to have access to the MP. They want to have your phone number. They want to text you back and forth. They want you to invest in their family, make sure they have food, backpacks, back to school returns, get them a job, secure them this and secure them that. And I want to know, what is the role of an MP in our system, or should be the role, advice to young politicians or would-be politicians?
Well, in the system, there are two roles. One is you are a delegate in the sense that you represent. You are an agent, and your principal is the vote. Principal is the voter. And that means that you are elected to go to Parliament to represent the views and opinions of those who elected you. There's a second role, and that role is also that of exercising your own deliberate judgment and conscience to issues which come before the House and before the Cabinet. And sometimes those two don't mesh, but you have to be adept at making sure that they do and that you serve the larger interests of the public. So I was looking at the stats the other day. In the United States, their lower house has one representative for 798,000 people. In the Bahamas, in New Providence, it's about 1 to 6,000 people. And in constituencies like Maical, it's more like 1 to 1,500 people. So in those circumstances where you have small groups of people, it is easy for those people to think that you could see each one of them, that you know each one of them, and that you can supply their needs, whether large or small. That comes down to all of the things that you listed. What I would say is that this time in office has been challenging because of the rise in poverty in the country in the last 5 years. In 2019, I believe it was, just before the pandemic, the central bank, may have been 18, may have been 19, the central bank did a survey. And the central bank survey said that families making $30,000 a year in the Bahamas, 50% of them reported that they can't make ends meet at the end of the month.
Wow.
So that meant, and what it means for a member of parliament today, is that walking around money is more important than ever before to meet needs which are immediate, whether grocery, school fees, uniforms, burying the dead, christening the baby, medical expenses. And a young politician today has to be ready to enter an arena where those are seen as justifiable demands by voters. When I was 21, I think I told you the last time I was here, I went to see Lyndon Pinling one morning. It must have been just before Christmas. And I was railing against the giving of hams and turkeys at Christmas. I didn't think that this was a role for a member of parliament. And how I came to it, of course, was I was the branch chair for Centerville, working with the late Anthony Roberts. And when Christmas time came as branch chair, we would spend the better part of an evening preparing packages with either turkey or ham or chicken and some goods to give people at Christmas time. And, of course, this is an enormous expense. So I went to him as this 20-something, and I said to Sir Lyndon, I said, you know, you fellas ought to be shaming yourself, you know, trying to get voters by giving them hams and turkeys. And he sort of looked with his hand under his chin, very bemused. And he said, well, you know, maybe in your lifetime, but not in mine. And now today, I give the same advice to those. That's just a feature of the politics. I don't think there's much you can do about it. But I do think that I told the Prime Minister coming back from just these five islands that what it reinforced to me is that there is a cash crunch in the country at the lower socioeconomic levels and in the middle class, which we have to do something almost immediately to rectify. And I hope that some liquidity is put into the system, additional liquidity is put into the system before Christmas time, because you get the sense that people are becoming rather desperate because they can't make ends meet. I was just in the office in Foxhill today, and a lady came up. I happened to be right up over social services. You know, just absolute desperation. No food to eat in the cupboard. None of her children are working. All of the children who are adults have moved back into her house. So there's overcrowding. So that's a real issue. And, you know, we have to be cognizant of it, which is why I said this morning on the radio, people were asking, what are we going to do to celebrate the first year in office? And I said, you know, we're not going to go around thumping our chests over this. We realize that the problems in the country are complex, that it's been challenging, that we're trying to rebuild an economy that was wrecked over 4.5 years. And we'll do it deliberately, and we'll try to have reasonable policies to make it better for people and their lives.
So let's talk about that. What the PLP plans moving forward after this first year, right? General, because I know you have to go and consult the board and executives, right? And may not be at liberty to speak. But we have a commercial break now. I'm speaking to Frederick Mitchell, Minister of the Public Service, Minister of Foreign Affairs, and we're having a great discussion. I'm learning a lot. We'll be right back after this brief message.
The new Guardian Radio app is here. Listen live to all our Guardian Radio shows and live video stream select programs in our studio. Get information about Guardian Radio shows and our hosts. Send messages, including text, email, and even call. All from our amazing new Guardian Radio app. Download it free today in your App Store for your Apple device or Play Store for your Android device. The all-new and improved Guardian Radio app.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
And welcome back to Guardian Radio in the AM. This is C.A. Nuri. I'm your host for today. I'm talking to Minister Frederick Mitchell, and we're having a discussion about his role in government. And we just was finished talking about the public service and a little briefly about the Foreign Affairs Ministry, and then the role of MPs moving forward and the challenges that MPs have. But today is the 16th. And this marks the 1 year anniversary of the PLP being the government.
Yes.
And I want you to give some commentary on that, about your accomplishments, some of the challenges you saw for this last year.
Look, I think the year has been a triumph for democracy,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that last year we couldn't get out of our houses. We had to run back at home before 8 o'clock in the night. You needed a letter from the prime minister to move from one island to the next. I think people were fed up with that, and it's done. And the economy is now back almost to pre-pandemic levels. So there's a kind of relief around. So I think that's a major accomplishment. And it's major because we've kept the society at peace. We haven't disintegrated into fighting amongst ourselves about where the thing ought to go forward. Now, there are a couple of flies in the ointment, of course. One of them is the level of violence amongst young people, which is concerning. And part of it has to do, of course, with the effects, the residual effects of the pandemic. But some of the signs were there before that we need to put in place stronger measures to deal with things like conflict resolution and your building affinity to things which are intangible, like family and friendships and loyalty to country and those things. But by and large, we've managed a stable state over the last year with economic growth, and we've been able to find the money to get some of our programs up and going. And I'm particularly pleased about what's happening in housing and also in the transportation sector. I think those are sort of bright spots. And our reserves are in good shape.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I'm very, with the PLP, the Progressive Liberal Party, impressed me with was their involvement of youth and women in their organization, and it, as if they're promoting it. It's part of their mandate to make sure they're involved. I know when you first entered politics, you were fairly young, 23-ish, right? And it was a culture of youth being involved. Is that something that the party has embraced again?
I have, it's axiomatic for me, certainly before the pandemic, I was at the University of the Bahamas every Tuesday at lunch, and just sitting around and trying to meet the leaders who would be shaping the country going forward. And I got to meet some of the sharper minds, including, you know, Dr. Michael Darvill, Shivago Lang, Zendel Forbes, Mike Halkidis, Reynard Rigby, Brad Johnson, who sadly passed away. They were all there at the university, Darren Cash, and they've all gone on to make their mark in the society. So I took a page out of an earlier discussion I had with then Assistant Commissioner Grafton Eiffel, and he was talking to me about the success of the recruitment program in the police force. And he said, you know, for the police force to be successful, every year it must get some people that it recruits out of each birth cohort. And, you know, a birth cohort is, I think it starts 0 to 4. But anyway, it's every age group. So what he was saying is every year when kids come out of school, the police force should recruit some people out of that class. Because he says the good guys in that class know the behavior of the bad guys in the class. Mm. So for the police force to remain relevant, you have to have some from each class. And I took that and I inwardly digested that. And I said, that's what we're going to do for the PLP. Every year, we're going to get our crew out of the University of the Bahamas. We're going to get our crew from the high schools and let them see how low the barriers to entry are to joining a political party. You look at two examples. I was a university lecturer filling in for Felix Bethel in the spring of 1988 at the university, at the then College of the Bahamas. And I was teaching politics and government. And in the class were Reynard Rigby and Mike Halkidis. So by the time 2002 came along, those same men had graduated from university, gone on to establish their careers. Mike Halkidis got elected to parliament, served as a parliamentary secretary, and Reynard Rigby was elected the chair of the Progressive Liberal Party. I think that's, 12 years or something between, if my math is correct. Anyway, my math's no good, but you know, you get
it. I understand.
But, you know, certainly within close to a decade, they were university students and then leaders of the country. So that told me that I was on the right track. And I still today think we have a PYL unit who works with the University of the Bahamas now to try and get make sure that we're in touch with the students there, because a party that does not commit itself to youth recruitment is actually looking at the graveyard. And that's not a place I want to be looking. I want to be looking toward the resurrection.
Okay. We can almost concluding the conversation with the minister. And I will conclude with this question. I mean, yeah. What is the way forward for the Bahamas? Which do you see is the need that where we should be targeting as a country?
This is a spectacularly beautiful place. I mean, I don't know if these children, I looked at some little children running up and down in Gregorytown and Eleuthera, which has a view from the top of the hill. Eddie Minnis actually painted the view once. And it is just spectacularly beautiful. And I said, I wonder if these little children understand how beautiful a place they live, how peaceful a place they live in, and what is available to them going forward. There are those like Pat Ramming that we could describe as jokers and clowns who come and try and take what we've got and take advantage of what we've got. We have to stop that, and we have to protect what is ours. And we have to build we can do that by building self-confidence in the generation which is coming up behind us. I got the highest degree of confidence from the way my parents treated me as a child coming up. I had no unhappiness. I lived in a solid family. We had no issues of poverty or deprivation of any kind. That life was afforded to me by the people of the Bahamas and the taxes and the government that existed. It also afforded me the social mobility, which allowed people who were born in humbler circumstances than I was to rise to the highest heights in the country. I always remember Sir Franklin Wilson telling me in Ross Corner that he slept on the floor. He was the last child in the house. He slept on the floor until his older sister got married, and then she moved out. And then he was able to have a space in a bed. And today he probably has 12 dozen beds available to him. That's the story you want to repeat in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. And we in the Progressive Liberal Party are committed to that. And I want to say in leaving, thank you to the people of the Bahamas for allowing us to manage our country. And we hope that we fulfill all the pledges that we do. And it's been a respectful year. And thank you all again from the bottom of our hearts.
And thank you, Minister, for joining me. This has been Guardian Radio in the AM with C.A. Nuri. I want to thank the Minister for making time out just to tell his story, tell his experience of being in government, and just to give us an update on what the Progressive Liberal Party is doing. And thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.